Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
This is Tim Staples of Catholic Answers. I'm excited to let you know that I also teach high school apologetics for homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. There are also recorded independent learning courses at homeschoolconnections.com. Whether you take apologetics with me, literature with Joseph Pierce, or philosophy with Bill Donahue, or any of the other 400 plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, it's a great way to get Catholic learning for your family.
Is the Supreme Court letting Catholics get away with discrimination? Joe Heschmeyer next. Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest is Catholic Answers apologist Joe Heschmeyer, the author of Pope Peter and a bunch of other books. And one of the things about Joe is he's a Catholic apologist, seminary trained, married, father of at least one that I know of. But he's also a lawyer. And so this week was a good week to have a talk with Joe because the United States Supreme Court in a decision called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, in a 9-0 decision, which was actually kind of a surprise, I think, to almost everyone on earth, in a unanimous decision, said that the City of Philadelphia could not, at least under the current conditions, tell Catholic social services that they were out of the foster care business because Catholic social services would not place children with gay couples. So we asked Joe to give us both a legal and a moral analysis of that decision and of our current situation. Here's what Joe had to say. Catholic Answers apologist Joe Heschmeyer, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
People may not know this about you, but you are also a lawyer.
Yeah, although not practicing. I'm more spiritual than lawyer. You shouldn't say they're not practicing on this show.
Yeah.
It means something very different.
I'm not spiritual or religious. In your case, more spiritual than lawyer. Okay, fair enough. So I feel like this is something we're going to take advantage of now that you are our colleague here at Catholic Answers, because there are issues where having the skills of an apologist and former seminarian who's also a lawyer comes in handy. And today's topic, and we have this decision from the United States Supreme Court, a unanimous decision allowing Catholic Social Services of Pennsylvania to discriminate against gay couples. Or at least that's the way it's being the first line of many stories around the country. I noticed NBC, a lot of them took that tack. Like, what, Supreme Court allows discrimination. Is that what happened here?
That's not what happened here. The Supreme Court actually stopped a little bit of discrimination from happening, although unfortunately give a little bit of a roadmap for how states can discriminate better.
Okay, so we do have two competing narratives here, and so two kind of different ways of I suppose saying who in fact is being discriminated against. And the truth is, Joe, just as a basic philosophical point, you can't have an entirely undiscriminating society. A society does have to make choices. Would you say that's fair?
Not only is that fair, former Attorney General John Ashcroft, when accused of legislating morality, once said that literally everything you legislate is morality because the only alternative is to legislate immorality. His right. point was that like every policy, even like seemingly like banal ones, yeah. is reflecting a series of value judgments you're making about the world. And those yeah. are going to be morally informed. Like there's no getting around that problem. Even something like, oh, should the speed limit in this area be 75 or 35? Well, that's going to reflect something about public safety and about transportation. Like right. you're making judgments about freedom and about safety and about all of those things. I mean, we saw this stuff with like the mask mandate. We saw this stuff with all sorts of things. Like we're constantly being asked to weigh competing goods. We're constantly being asked to make discriminations and judgments about things. And so anyone pretending that we can just not legislate that way doesn't understand at a basic level, like the way all legislation is to some extent, one group imposing their morality on another. Because if everyone agreed that X was a good idea, you wouldn't actually need to make X a law because no one's going to violate it.
All right. Okay. Fair enough. So here we come to a choice then between narratives about who's being discriminated in this sense that I do think that a lot of advocates of gay marriage, a lot of people who embrace gay marriage and are generally, you know, accepting of the whole movement towards, you know, it's Pride Month now here in the United States. And this whole movement towards a kind of acceptance that says love is love, you know, in as applied in a pride way, you know, in a gay pride way. Okay. So I do feel like many, many people feel like, well, that's done. That work is done. And so they are actually shocked when they find out there's people who are like, we didn't fully actually buy on to that. You know, just because there was the Obergefell decision, it didn't end our moral objection to same-sex marriage. And so I do think that people, and maybe fairly so, because the media acts as if, well, we've all moved on. But literally half of the country has not moved on and did not agree to any of this.
Yeah, you know, it is one of those things where there was sort of a declaration from on high through the Supreme Court. Like, it's striking that this wasn't something where people took to, you know, the ballot box and they voted for this and this is what they decided on. This was legislated from on high by unelected judges. So, like, that's one of the ways of understanding kind of the way this whole conversation is playing out, is that the court actually has a hand in creating some of the problems because they're not letting this work out kind of in a democratic way. They're not letting, like, the populace figure out what they understand marriage in their own society to be. They need these unelected judges who don't have much necessarily philosophy to make these real philosophical and moral claims on behalf of the country and impose them on everyone. You know, like Anthony Kennedy just declaring that there's no rational reason someone could be against same-sex marriage is almost a joke when you look at the whole span of human history.
No.
Where until very, very recently, almost everyone viewed it as not even a possibility.
Right. But Anthony Kennedy, also famous for the what's called the sweet mystery of life passage in another. he tended to be more poetic than philosophical, I think, as a judge. But what I'm trying to get at here is that I do think there is a part of the population that, because media went along, because all the universities went along, because public schools went along, and you know, so all the things that they see as the institutions of society said, yes, we're fully on board, this is done, they are actually shocked to find out that there's a whole Catholic population and a wider Christian population, and actually many other people as well, who didn't go along with this. And so to them, it seems quite clear. There was this great progress in civil rights happened, and then there's these regressives. Why is the Supreme Court taking the side of these reactionary and regressive people?
Yeah, I like that you mentioned the sweet mystery of life passage, because I think it actually comes into one of the differences in how religion is conceptualized, where there is a view that you'll find, including by some members of the court, that religion is basically something that you privately hold, like it's a set of interior beliefs,
right?
But it doesn't have to impact anything exterior. Like, it doesn't have to impact, like, the way you live or the way you behave. And so the idea that something could be like an imposition on your religion, the whole notion of exercise, like free exercise of religion, becomes very confusing if your understanding of religion was that it's a bunch of, like, basically superstitions that you privately have but don't live by.
Right.
Like, that's, you know, like Justice Scalia famously argued that the other side on this question treated religion the way people treated pornography, is like something that could be shamefully indulged in private.
But don't bring it over
something
here.
Fit for. Yeah, yeah. Don't. Yeah, exactly. Don't do it in public.
Yeah, right. We reverse those things, I think, as a matter of fact. But OK, so that's the one side of this. Mm-hmm. The other side, the one that I have to admit I belong to, I don't want to pretend some false neutrality here. So says, wait a second. Even if the society decides, well, we're going to have gay marriage, that's the law. And that's and it does seem in many ways that with a general acquiescence, that fight in any real sense is over. Okay, so, but even if we agree to that, people like myself will say, well, that does not mean that everyone has to abandon their long-held moral convictions in order to make that as convenient and as unquestioned as possible. Like, you still get to say, I don't believe in gay marriage. You still get to say, I'm not going to officiate at a gay marriage. I'm not going to, you know, bake the cake for the gay marriage. I'm not going to assist in this couple adopting children. And that is not, at least in my view, that's not just a kind of regressive refusal to give up bigotry, but it's just saying, well, no, I don't have the power to do anything about this. I'm just not involved. I don't want to be involved in it. Leave me out of it. And I'd like to do what I'm doing as a Catholic without being required to participate or affirm what I don't participate in or affirm.
Well, and that was kind of the way this whole thing was sold at the outset.
But always,
you know, there was the idea, you know, like, yeah. Hey, there's that bumper sticker pretty famously in the lead up to all this that said, don't like gay marriage, don't have one.
Yeah.
And it seems like if you were going to do an updated version of that bumper sticker, it'd be like, don't like gay marriage, don't have a job.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
You know, you can't do anything.
Yeah. Don't participate in civic life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the thing so in this case that we're looking at today, Fulton v. Philadelphia, there wasn't even a same-sex couple that had approached Catholic Charities. It was just the idea that if one did, they would have said no. That was enough for the city to refuse to do business with Catholic Charities. So there are a bunch of kids who aren't going to get placed in foster homes or won't be placed as efficiently or as effectively. They'll be left in the foster system longer because hypothetically a couple might have been discriminated against by one of the numerous agencies in the city, even though it's the one that anyone who seriously is wanting to adopt isn't going to be going to Catholic Charities if they're in a gay union. Like, the one who you're not going to go into that one. And so it's pretty incredible, I think, given that, like, the state where we're at is no longer, this is a minority group whose rights we're really interested in trying to protect. It much more is imposing that on everyone around them. Now, there's an important, I think, backdrop here in terms of civil rights, especially like the history of interracial discrimination, like with Jim Crow laws. Between Jim Crow laws and private racist businesses, it was often very difficult to get public accommodations as an African-American living or traveling through the South. So finding a hotel you could stay at, finding a restaurant you could eat at was incredibly difficult. And so one of the things that comes up in these cases is what's called public accommodations, that basically if you're a member of the public, there needs to be somewhere where you can sleep at night. There needs to be somewhere where you can eat. And so someone discriminating against you in those kind of basic ways is doing something pretty grotesque. So even though they're a private business there, we do take a tougher stance. Does that make like, we're yeah. trying to make sense that you can't just say, well, they're a private business, therefore they can do whatever they want.
No.
If 100% of the people in a particular community are going to do that in a racist way, that means like some portion of the population won't be served.
May I add one thing to that, Joe?
Yeah.
That also race and sexual behavior are not analogous to one another. Mm-hmm. And race is a particularly pernicious, has a particularly pernicious history in the United States. So that the analogy of, well, black people were treated this way, therefore, and then you pick some other group, like, you know, people that want to wear tutus or, you know, some, therefore, the analogy. Well, actually, that is not an analogy, because what happened to African people being brought to the United States and enslaved and then hundreds of years, that's not analogous to anything else. So the remedies for that are actually going to be different than every other remedy. Get over it.
Yeah, exactly. Like there are all sorts of basic principles. You know, as a general rule, the right to refuse service is something that we've tended to affirm and support for a private business. And this one narrow category of cases where it's being abused in this pretty horrific, but like you said, singular way, it made sense that the government responded with federal authority and force, like sending in troops into the South. This is a very unique set of circumstances. To turn that into a general principle that a cake maker should have to make whatever cake you want even if it's something that's super offensive and goes against everything they believe in.
Right.
That's just not a valid way of drawing out that, you know, and we see this all the time. And I'm glad you're saying this, because this idea that like GLBTQ, et cetera, is the new civil rights is a really popular kind of mantra. And it's really historically ignorant. Like, there just is not an analogous set of circumstances, nor are, like you said, sexual orientation and sexual practice aren't the same things as race. Like, the idea that someone can't go anywhere or do anything without being discriminated against based on their skin color, and if something visible from the outside, is automatically a very different kind of circumstance than this person thinks what I'm doing is immoral. Well, right. Okay, people are free to think what you're doing is immoral.
Right. And it's and especially when those judgments about what's moral or immoral have a grounding in probably the most ancient kinds of philosophical arguments. I mean, you go back to Aristotle and the same arguments would be made. I cannot imagine that Aristotle would be in favor of gay marriage, for example. Well, okay, he's old and we don't trust the ancient people, but they were very comfortable with homosexual behavior in ancient Athens, but that doesn't mean Aristotle would have reasoned his way to gay marriage. So what I'm trying to say is you have moral arguments of an ancient and noble provenance, and they're to be not accepted because they make somebody have to go to a different cake shop.
Yeah, it is a pretty remarkable kind of thing. Although let's just point this out, like, even if they weren't of a noble and ancient provenance,
yeah,
even if it was just something much more like trendy and new, like if I ran a vegan restaurant and I refused to serve non-vegans, that should be totally legal, because a non-vegan can go to any other restaurant anywhere in the city and get service. They're not going to go hungry that night. This isn't like Jim Crow.
Do you mean refuse to serve non-vegans non-vegan food, or refuse to serve
just
vegans?
Like if they wanted to say, if you are morally okay with eating animal flesh,
we won't serve
you in this restaurant. Yeah. Like right. That might be against the way we currently impose discrimination law.
Right.
But it seems to me that there's no reason not to allow someone that kind of framework.
Well,
that kind of
I remember when a prominent member of the Trump administration tried to eat in a restaurant in Washington, D.C., and they refused her service because she was a member of the Trump administration. I actually don't think that was immoral on their part. If they actually think Trump is a Nazi, I think you get to say, no, we don't serve Nazis here. You might be right. You might be wrong in your estimation. But I think that, to me, perhaps I'm wrong about that, Joe.
No, so I at least agree with you. I think that, but the reason we don't do that in this country now, even though it would seem based on all the principles we hold up, the reason we don't do that is largely because of this kind of holdover from the civil rights movement, where
right.
We saw people abuse it in this one category and we got kind of skittish about it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So what's the kind of background for this particular case? Like, what's the... I mean, we keep hearing, is this a broad decision or a narrow decision? Does it affect this earlier decision or not affect that? Some people are saying the Supreme Court's playing a kind of game. We should point out it was a unanimous decision. I mean, this was not apparently a tough one for the Supreme Court. So give us the background.
Yeah. So the case is called Fulton v. Philadelphia. And Fulton there is Sharon L. Fulton. She's a Philadelphia foster mom that has fostered more than 40 kids over the course of 25 years. And she fosters kids through Catholic Social Services. And so Catholic Social Services gets a portion of their money from the city. The way Philadelphia does foster care is a combination of public and private, which is, I think, the way almost everyone, if not everyone, handles things like foster care. You don't want the state directly handling all of this. You know, like, the people who run the DMV shouldn't be in charge of taking care of kids, their own or others. So they give
money. Come on now,
to,
Joe.
just kidding. If anyone listening to the DMV, probably you should get back to work.
Oh my gosh.
Just kidding.
Moving on.
I know one guy who works for the Postal Service who listens to this, so I didn't pick on the Postal Service. But no, the point is that, like, the city is working with these private groups, some of which are faith-based. But this isn't the city doing a favor for the Catholic Church. It's the other way around. I mean, it's the Catholic Church taking care of the poor and needy, and in this case, taking care of the orphans, which is a part of our religion. It's a part of what we believe in. And it's in kind of conjunction with this public service of trying to do the same thing. That's where all of this kind of like the connection between the city and Catholic social services comes in. The problem is the city hearing the representative for Catholic social services, or else for the archdiocese, I don't remember which, basically saying that in a hypothetical situation, they wouldn't be able to place the child with a same-sex couple.
Yeah.
Philadelphia responded by basically making that illegal and saying, like, you're not going to get any state funds if you do that. But there's a twist where they had an exemption clause in the sole discretion of the commissioner. Basically like this, they have a general kind of blanket thing saying anyone who works with the city and its foster care has to be willing to certify and potentially place kids with same-sex couples. But because they knew that this could be really hard, it's like a universally applied rule, they had this exemption clause where the commissioner could relax that in particular cases. Mm-hmm. It was entirely discretionary. That is going to be a really important point for the majority for reasons we'll get into. But that's kind of what's going on here, that, you know, the city is trying to force Catholic social services to either place with same-sex couples or go out of business or just stop doing work with the city. And this is not the first time this has happened. Washington, D.C., while I was living there, passed a really similar rule. And the cardinal went to them and said, if you do this, we'll have to stop placing kids. And they said, yeah, that's the point. Like, there it was pretty yeah. much targeted and directly was meaning to get the Catholic Church out of this.
So in a certain way, does the brazenness of it by the city of Philadelphia kind of let the Supreme Court off the hook of having to decide a deeper issue, because they can just say, look, this is obvious animus against Catholics, fix it?
Yeah, there's a saying in law that bad cases make bad law.
Yeah.
And there's a few ways that that can happen. One is that, like, sometimes if a particular set of facts tugs at your heartstrings, you'll bend the law to try to make it work.
Uh-huh.
And that can be really dangerous. But the other way bad cases make bad law is sometimes the case is just so extreme that everyone can see, like, no, obviously this doesn't work.
Right.
But they don't necessarily get into the issues they need to and make the kind of principled distinctions. This is that second category. Like, this is a case where what they did was so flagrantly unconstitutional that you can't just say, we don't like you, we're not going to do business with you because we disagree with your religious views. That's not going to be good enough.
No.
But there is a big question based on what's called the Smith case, or Employment Division v. Smith, that the court has for today kind of skated around, but I think we've got the lineup ready to see what that next case might look like.
Okay, so the Employment Division case written by notorious liberal jurist Antonin Scalia. a lot of people who, you know, who would be great admirers of Antonin Scalia would say, no, he got that one wrong. And so that's really at the underneath all of this is this question of, Is Scalia's argument in that case reasonable? Will that allow for a proper respect of the First Amendment and of the religion's place in society, or will it not? Am I basically right about what's at issue here?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background on that case just to get how we ended up in this situation. That was back in the 90s. There was a drug rehab counselor in Oregon, ironically, who was in trouble for using peyote. And his name was, I think, Al Smith. And he was a member of the Native American Church, and they claimed it was basically sacramental use of peyote. Mm-hmm. And so there was a kind of a weird set of situation, you know, weird set of circumstances. It wasn't something that was like a widespread religious belief at the time in the 90s, you know, that and so it was viewed as this kind of like weird fringe thing. And so then the question became, well, can they impose this general rule against drug use, even on religious groups that are okay, not just okay with drug use, but actually make certain hallucinogenic or ethnogenic drugs part of their religious ceremonies?
Right.
So that was the situation kind of facing the court. We could imagine an even more extreme situation facing the court. So, like, imagine like ancient Aztec religion where they did human sacrifice.
Right.
Could you have a law forbidding all murder, or you have to include a, unless it's for human sacrifice, kind of clause.
Right.
That's what the court's kind of worried about. Like, and so in the case, Scalia says to make an individual's obligation to obey such a law contingent upon the law's coincidence with his religious belief, except where the state's interest is compelling, permitting him by virtue of his belief to become a law unto himself contradicts both constitutional tradition and common sense. To adopt a true compelling interest requirement for laws that affect religious practice would lead to anarchy. So it's a pretty fascinating kind of decision, because at the time, that's a 5-4 decision, effectively. It's technically, I think, a 6-3. There's a concurrence with O'Connor. But it ends up being either a 5-4 or 6-3, where it's the liberals who are in dissent saying you're not giving enough room to religious freedom here. So it's a fascinating kind of shift in the way like the court's jurisprudence has gone in the last 30 years. And in response to Employment Division v. Smith, Congress was kind of shocked, saying this is too far. And so they passed RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and they passed it, I think, like 97-3 or something. I mean, it was not unanimous,
I remember.
Like nearly unanimous, because it was like, obviously Smith is a bad case. That was kind of the approach. In other words, we're at this place where what Scalia was worried about is real. Like,
yes,
okay,
sure,
if someone could just say, I'm religiously opposed to this, that's actually kind of a troubling thing. But on the other hand, the conclusion he comes up with, which is to say a neutral law of general applicability, as it can pass pretty easily. It has a much lower standard of scrutiny. That doesn't seem like the right answer to that problem.
No.
So that's kind of where we are. Like,
well, we get to the problem.
If
we go back to the basic premise we started with, that law is about morality, there's no such thing as a neutral law in that sense. I mean, they're all going to assert some moral position, and so you're kind of, well, what does neutral mean in that sense? Neutral just means it's supposed to apply to everybody, but that's what general applicability means. So why say
true.
Neutral?
But it's meant to be something that isn't targeted with an anti-religious animus.
Oh, I see.
So there's
neutral
some really
as to religion.
Cases.
Yeah.
Yes. So, for instance, there were the Santeria kind of religion does weird animal sacrifices. And so there was a locality that had actually passed a law like forbidding, I think it was the killing of chickens, except for use in food. They were very clearly targeting, even though it was generally applicable to everyone other than food producers.
Yeah.
It was not neutral in the sense that they were targeting Santeria and saying, we think what you're doing is gross and shouldn't be legal.
Yeah.
That is directly against the First Amendment. Like, that one's not going to pass constitutional muster. When you're just saying, stop your religion, that's not going to work.
Right.
So that's another one of those, like, you know, that law didn't take long to knock down.
Yeah, because everyone else has the right to kill a chicken. Then the only person who doesn't is the Santeria guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And like the fact that you can kill the chicken for food but not for religion means that you're not treating them neutrally. You're not treating them equally. Even though you're not specifying Santeria in the law, we can tell from both like the context in which the law was passed and the fact that you've got two sets of standards, one for food producers, one for religious practitioners, and you're holding them to different rules.
Okay, so in this case, however, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was not invoked. They just argued that on First Amendment grounds, this was unacceptable. And Philadelphia, by being excessive, made that an easy argument, it would appear, because 9 justices agreed.
It actually, in some ways, they weren't excessive enough. By that, I mean, remember earlier when I mentioned the exemption clause that at the sole discretion of the commissioner, he could not apply the non-discrimination provisions?
Yeah.
That made it like the Santeria case, where the groups the commissioner likes are held to one standard, and the groups the commissioner doesn't like are held to a different standard.
And he doesn't
like Catholic Charities. And he doesn't like them for nakedly religious reasons. That made it a really easy case of obviously imposing something where this is not a neutral law of general applicability. And we know it's not of general applicability because the non-discrimination provision is explicitly not generally applicable. That makes it a targeted anti-religious law, which means you have a much higher standard you'd have to meet to be able to pass constitutional muster.
Well, could a municipality say, for example, we just think the reasoning behind your religious belief is flawed, And you can't justify that reasoning. So we don't accept your, like, can society just say, well, that's, we don't accept your reasoning, therefore you can't follow through on that religious belief. Would that be reason?
Not constitutional. I mean, well, so there's three different standards. So you'd have the highest standard of legal scrutiny. It's called strict scrutiny. And it's very hard to pass strict scrutiny. So if something is directly like regulating a religion, you could get into strict scrutiny territory. But I don't actually know offhand, at least, of any situations that would pass that kind of muster.
Well, that, I bring that up in part, Joe, because and I want to play a little audio for you. The media seems very focused on, well, this is just an unreasonable Catholic belief. Like you're it's internally inconsistent, therefore you shouldn't be allowed to have it. And I'm going to play you some audio from Steve Inskeep, who's the reporter on, he is a reporter, I can assure you he's a reporter on National Public Radio Morning Edition. And he asked six questions of the Beckett Fund lawyer, six questions about this case. Three of them were about, isn't Catholic belief stupid, essentially, is what he's asking. Just play the audio and we'll see. I'll see if you got the same impression I did about these
now,
questions.
Now, we should be clear, Ms. Windham, we're discussing constitutional rights, legal rights here, and not necessarily the underlying beliefs which people have a right to have. But I do want to address the substance, the underlying belief here. You should know that I'm an adoptee. I'm an adoptive parent. I'm very familiar with same-sex adoptive parents who I would regard as excellent parents, and I'm just reporting here. I'm a reporter. I'm reporting what I've witnessed. If Catholic Social Services looks at a same-sex couple who are willing to serve as foster parents, what makes Catholic Social Services conclude they would not be suitable parents? Although I'm trying to understand why they wouldn't work with that couple. As I understand it, the agency says it would be okay with a single foster parent who might very well be gay or lesbian. What changes when there happen to be two parents in the household? So it's not actually about protecting the kids then. It's about the social worker from the Catholic agency who might feel uncomfortable.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get at in this line of questioning, this persistent line of questioning, and I have to admit, I do laud Steve Inskeep for saying that he is in favor of gay couples adopting. So I do think it's actually healthy when reporters tell you their bias. Hiding bias is the problem. But he's pressing her, this lawyer, on essentially trying to justify Catholic belief. But in constitutional law, do we have to justify the belief, or do we have to say this is our belief? And we can't do that, and that's enough.
So I think the answer is going to be one answer on paper and one answer in practice. Okay. Meaning on paper, it shouldn't matter. Something like Jewish kosher laws are one of the issues that came up in this case. Could you have a regulation that requires pork to be in food and then not include an exception for Jews? According to Smith, the answer to that would be yes. That's a pretty bad outcome, which is one of the things that one of the concurrences points out. But notice that in that, you don't have to say, oh, yeah, the kosher laws make sense. You can just say, obviously, this is a sincerely held
right.
belief that many, you know, this would actually violate a lot of people's religious freedom, even if I don't agree with, you know, the whole theology behind kosher laws or whatever. Like, the court doesn't have to get into, does this law make sense to us? And they shouldn't. But having said that, so that's on paper, right? Like, it shouldn't matter on paper. But in practice, the judges are human. The justices are human. Yeah. Like, everyone evaluating these is looking at whether they can understand how the other side is able to get to that conclusion. And if they can't, if it doesn't make any sense to them, then their tendency is to think that, okay, this must just be a mask for discrimination. In other words, like, I can't see any way a logical person would believe in these things, so you must not really believe in them. You must be just telling me these so you can justify discriminating against someone.
See. Yeah.
And the same way that if you found out, like, Smith didn't really believe his religion, he just really liked doing peyote,
yeah,
that's going to make it harder for him to win that case. Like, we do look at that, whether we should or shouldn't. And so in that sense, I think one of the mistakes we made on the Catholic side was when the whole gay marriage fight came out, we largely argued on religious freedom grounds. or the contraceptive, like the HHS mandate. We largely argued on religious freedom grounds that, like, well, we shouldn't be forced to impose, like, you shouldn't impose on us this requirement to provide contraception or to help set someone up with contraception because it's against our religion. And we probably should have been doing a better job then of making the actual case against contraception. So it didn't seem like just this weird arbitrary thing that we have. The word taboo comes from this whole system of Hawaiian like moral norms and like indigenous Hawaiian society, where it was just like there were all sorts of things where like men and women couldn't sit at the same table together, but they could engage in all sorts of what we would describe as immoral sexual practices. They just couldn't eat together afterwards.
Right. And the women couldn't eat pork. It's the most unfair, but okay, go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, we've got a new Hawaiian restaurant like a few blocks from here. It's amazing. Yeah. And so, yeah, to deny them that pork. Anyway, the idea was like these were just irrational rules that everyone held to because they were just like the system that the society held to. That once upon a time, they may have made sense. But once no one could articulate the reason behind them, they just became these arbitrary rules. And so when the king eventually just got rid of the taboo system, there wasn't a major outcry because no one really knew why they were doing it.
Right.
That's kind of I think that's the situation which a lot of people outside the church view the church's teaching on marriage, on contraception, on a host of other issues, that if we're just saying, well, this is just not for me, we need to be doing something better for legal reasons as well as kind of evangelical reasons.
Okay. All right. So what do you see coming up? Because I do feel that in a great part of Catholic media, if you watched, you know, Catholic television news or listened to many Catholic podcasts, and I would include us in this on many occasions, there is a growing anxiety about, well, religious freedom is going away. All the signs point in the wrong direction. You know, the New York Times reported this as this is another case where the court always sides with religion, you know, so the other side doesn't see it that way. How do you see this as is there any value as a harbinger in this case or how do you see this as part of a longer kind of trying to work this out as a society?
Yeah, I think there's a few things going on. One is, you know, for the reasons we talked about, the kind of impasse we found ourselves in with the Smith case, that seems to be going by the wayside. So in the case before us today, you have three opinions that were written. So you get the majority opinion, and then you have two concurrences. Now, a concurring opinion agrees with the outcome, but often uses a different line of reasoning to get there, or sometimes will want to make some other kind of point that isn't directly before the court. So that's one of the ways that the justices kind of show their cards a little bit and maybe point to the direction the law might be going. So in this case, you have a majority opinion that Roberts, Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett signed on to. But you also have these two concurrences. In one of the concurrences, Barrett and Kavanaugh, and in part Breyer, argue basically, yeah, there's some real problems with Smith, but if we don't really know what to replace it with yet, but it seems like something needs to happen. So, you know, at one point they say, yeah, what should replace Smith? The prevailing assumption seems to be that strict scrutiny would apply whenever a neutral and generally applicable law burdens religious exercise. But she says, I'm skeptical about swapping Smith's categorical anti-discrimination approach for an equally categorical one, basically in the other direction. You know, so that's one concurrence. So if you're doing just a head count, you've got three people who are right there saying something's wrong with Smith, but we're a little uneasy about the switch as well. The other concurrence by Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch is much more strong in just being like stridently like Smith is a bad case. It leads to bad conclusions. We need to get rid of Smith. But the RFRA also isn't really like the fix. So they're also kind of pointing to like a direction we need to go. One of the things we can take from that is that it looks just by counting heads that there's at least five or six of them who are saying, okay, Smith is a bad case. We're just not quite ready because only three of us are ready to pull the trigger now. Three more are saying, we know it's a bad case. We're not ready to pull the trigger now. That means, in other words, that like the signal they're sending to lawyers and to scholars is basically come up with a good argument about what could replace it. And if you can convince enough of us, we're
That'll
looking,
be the law.
You know, like,
yeah.
Right. I mean, it's almost like they're saying, I don't like the person I'm dating now, but I'm not quite ready to date somebody else. Like they're, they're sending that
convince
kind of a
me.
Signal.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. Okay. Talk me out of this because this feels like an unhealthy relationship we've got with Smith. Like that's one of the places that we're going. So what does that mean in practice? Well, it means in practice that we could be getting to a place with greater protection, probably for explicitly religious groups like Catholic Charities.
Yeah.
So they're kind of moving in one direction, in a largely healthy direction. I'm more worried about groups like Hobby Lobby, which seem to be moving in the other direction of having fewer and fewer.
Right.
So we seem to be moving into this weird kind of two-tiered system.
Yeah.
We're a group that is explicitly religious by its constitution, is given a lot of wiggle room to exercise, but a group that is just run by individual Christians or individual believers of whatever religion is held to a much different and worse standard because on paper, like the company is not a religious body.
Yeah.
And so basically like individual rights kind of go down in that system while like organizational rights go up.
Well, let me just ask you this as a Catholic person, as a person who has thought about this both legally and morally, is there a way forward for a society this fractured on such fundamental issues as life and marriage and death? And, you know, these are really, intoxicants, such basic questions that we really do not have and really seem incapable at the moment of having any kind of consensus on. I mean, I suppose there are many conservative people who will say, well, the answer is federalism. Let the states decide. Don't stop federalizing all these issues. I that might be good in theory, but if people won't accept that as an answer, then that's clearly not the answer, because in a democracy, you got to get people to accept the answer. So is there a way forward, for example, let's just narrow it back down to this case. In the city of Philadelphia, if Christian people say, look, we don't believe that gay marriage is marriage because these are the things we believe about marriage, and we're never going to believe that. And we don't believe that children being adopted by a gay couple is the moral equivalent of children being adopted by a heterosexual couple. Or, and this I think was also in this case, we don't believe that a non-married heterosexual couple is the moral equivalent of a married heterosexual couple. Like we just, and we're not going to get there. You're not going to eventually wear us down. We're not going to get there. But we also know we can't change those laws. Is there a way that we can all participate together in civic life? Or is culture war and civic strife just our fate now? We're stuck with it.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to two prefaces. One is you caught me at a bad day on this because
you're thinking, no, it's all hopeless.
Yeah. I'm thinking like this morning I was reading Charles Sumner's famous speech, Crime Against Kansas. So tomorrow, we're recording this on the 18th. Tomorrow is Juneteenth, the anniversary of emancipation. And so I was reading a little bit about the history of kind of Kansas's involvement. And Kansas was supposed to be a free state. And slave owners actually got the federal law changed to try to make it come in as slave.
Right.
And at one point, so Charles Sumner then gives up and gives a 5-hour speech just like lambasting them. In response to which one of the other senators gets up and beats him to within an inch of his life with a cane.
On
the
Oh,
yeah.
Right. I forgot.
But in his speech, he says the contest, which beginning in Kansas has reached us, will soon be transferred to a broader stage where every citizen will be not only spectator, but actor.
Oh, that's
and
so
frightening. He was kind of like, it was foreboding. He realized like they won't stop. I mean, he said it wasn't enough basically that they have slavery in the states they have. They were worried about being outvoted in Congress, so they were trying to force slavery onto free areas. And so he points this, like, they can't just be privately immoral. They're basically evangelists for this so-called peculiar institution. Like, the slave owners were arguing, like, we should invade Cuba, we should invade Central America to bring in more, like, basically territory in the country that could become slave states. This is like, in other words, like we often remember this as a fight over like states' rights. They were not actually in favor of states like Kansas and Nebraska coming in according to what they had agreed on in 1830. everything kind of went out the door. All of the kind of logical principles by which the country seemingly could have moved forward fell by the wayside, and it responded with like this kind of like oppressive violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why I mentioned like one of the prefaces, like, we've seen ourselves in a worse spot before, but there's some echoes, shall we say.
Right. Right. And a relentless drive for conformity on this is not going to end well.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's the other thing. The second is like, you know, that famous monkey trap where like the monkey puts his hand in the coconut and grabs the nuts. But if he would just let go. Yeah, yeah. All he has to do is let go and then he can get his hand free. But he can't let go of it because he just like he wants it too much. We could easily discuss like what would it look like to peacefully coexist. Would look like you're not forcing Catholic charities to place with same-sex couples. Like the Catholic Church
that,
isn't
yeah,
like
that is actually
trying to stop. Yeah.
Right. You still have 40 other agencies that are doing it. Just let Catholic. That does seem like a reasonable compromise, but they will not accept that as a compromise. The
exactly.
advocates on the other side.
That's the analogy I'm drawing to, kind of the way that it wasn't enough for the slave owners to be told like, okay, well, you do this in your own state. That they really were kind of the aggressors in trying to push this long before the abolitionist movement really got aggressive and kind of pushing back in the other direction.
Yeah. I did hear a man defending the position of the people who want Catholic charities or Catholic social services to provide this service to gay couples. Okay. And he said, well, why doesn't the church just focus on the welfare of children and get out of this business of same-sex marriage? And I thought that's what they want to do. Like he doesn't see that he's not letting them do that. I mean, he's got the nut and he won't let go of it. He won't take it. Like they literally just want to focus on the welfare of children and they don't want to participate in the gay marriage thing. Just leave them alone and that's what will happen.
Exactly. I mean, this was, again, like, I want to really stress this. This was entirely hypothetical.
Yeah, right.
That Philadelphia was worried.
There were no actual
hypothetically,
cases.
Hypothetically, yeah. Someone could be discriminated against. And so we're going to stop this really helpful work. Like, no one is complaining, like, oh, Catholic Charities isn't placing kids with families. That's not coming. You know, like, if apparently, yeah. by all accounts, they're doing a good job. They've been working in Philadelphia for 200 years.
Yeah.
And they're being told, like, no, you've got to stop. Because in theory, you might not basically go with the new flow of the new morality.
Right.
That is an incredible kind of dogmatism, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Like that's just saying like, in the same way that if the Catholic Church were saying, hey, this agency over here doesn't believe all Catholic principles. So even though it hasn't ever come up, we want them stopped.
Right.
Like no one would doubt like, whoa, you're being really kind of oppressive in the way you're approaching your religious beliefs and practices.
Yeah,
we've got the same thing on the other side, but because they don't know that they're religious, they aren't aware of kind of how fanatically devoted to their religious system and their moral system they are. Because this is, I mean, like in fairness to the other side, they're acting on principles. Like they're
Without
not being
question.
Malicious. They're being fanatically principled.
Yeah, right, right. Fair enough. It's not anti-Catholic. They would accept us as Catholics if we would just say we accept this one thing. It's not a general
yeah,
answer.
It's like, yeah, if we weren't Catholic, they'd be fine with us. But yeah.
Okay, so fine.
All right.
Fair enough. Thank you, Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers Apologist.
My pleasure.
I'm so glad we have Joe to have these discussions with. And while we focused primarily on the legal and to some degree, philosophical and historical issues here, at the root of this, there's a fundamental moral disagreement going on. And that also needs its time. And I have to say, we do that in lots of places on our website, Catholic.com, and in the way we answer questions on the air, and even here in episodes of Catholic Answers Focus. I don't want to neglect to say that that's important, that the moral issues underneath all of this are the ultimate cause of the energy around this, that there's one side saying morality looks like this and another side saying morality looks like this, and they are exclusive to one another. And so this is going to require a great deal of listening, dialogue, conversation in order to move forward. I hope we can have all that listening, dialogue, and conversation. And more than anything, to do so in a way that is charitable to one another. So I hope that nothing here sounded uncharitable while we tried to work out, you know, things that are on a really on a lesser level, on a shallower level, legal kind of and historical questions. Because at the depth of it, we're all God's children. He wants us to have the fullness of his love, and he wants us to love one another with fullness. So let's just leave with that. Thanks very much to Joe Heschmeyer. Hey, if you want to support us here at Catholic Answers Focus, we do need your support to keep doing what we're doing. And you can support us by going to givecatholic.com and maybe leave a little note that says this donation is for Catholic Answers Focus. If you're listening on a podcast service right now, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, something like that, please subscribe. That way you'll be notified when new episodes are available. And if you watch us on YouTube, man, we're growing on YouTube and we want to keep growing on YouTube. You liking and subscribing right down here is one of the ways that that growth happens. Once again, I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Always grateful when you join us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus. I'm really happy that we have Juneteenth as a holiday now. I think it's great.
I am too. I think people are knocking. I actually grew up. So the neighborhood I grew up in was about 50% white, 50% black. So I grew up aware of Juneteenth. It didn't really kind of get what it was, but I knew people had a big party. And once you hear what it is, you're like, oh, this is cool. Like this should, everyone should celebrate this.
Yeah.
In the same way that like, you don't have to live in Europe to celebrate VE Day. Like you don't have to live in the places that are liberated to still be like, well, I'm glad it happened.
Yeah.
So too, like, even if you're not a descendant of slaves,
right,
it's still a good thing that we don't have slavery anymore.
It's a great thing. And it's not, and it doesn't have anything to do with our current, like, arguments over whatever we're arguing over. It's just a great thing to celebrate. It's, and I have to admit, it's another summer holiday. Just get over it, people. all right. Well, fair enough. I'm going to tell you one other thing too about Bloody Kansas that you may not know this. This is something that I know that I find many people don't know. Quantrill, the guy, the racist SOB who went around killing people in Kansas and Missouri if they were Union people, a murderer, a torturer, a killer of. Do you know that he got wounded? He was shot, I think, in Tennessee at the end of the war, was being cared for in a military hospital. A Catholic priest came up and talked to him about the Catholic faith, and he converted to Catholicism and was baptized before he died.
Beautiful.
Did you not know that?
I did not know.
Like maybe the worst man in American history, but, and nobody knows this. He repented and died a Catholic.
That's beautiful. I'm glad to hear you repented too.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it. You have to in order to receive baptism. So peace, Joe.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye.